I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold. When we talk about inequality, the conversation often breaks down into two sides, the rich versus the poor, the 1% versus the 99%. In a story with two sides, there's usually a winner and a loser.
But what if the wealthy wanted everyone to win? In this episode, we speak with Morris Pearl, a former managing director at BlackRock, who now serves as the chair of an organization called Patriotic Millionaires. Patriotic Millionaires is a group of high net worth individuals who believe that all Americans would be better off in a more prosperous, stable, and inclusive nation.
We ask Morris how we can get to that more inclusive place and why the wealthy should care.
My name is Morris Pearl. I'm the chairman of the board of a group called the Patriotic Millionaires. We have a group of some hundreds of wealthy business people and investors and retired people all over the United States. And we're basically trying to explain to our government officials and to our people that rich people actually do not want gross inequality in our country. We actually prefer having a country with a robust middle class of people who pay their bills every month, their cell phone bills, their rent, their mortgage payments, their car payments, go out to eat at restaurants, buy fancy ice cream, buy expensive shoes, because that's how we get rich in our businesses. We can't build businesses and invest in a country that's filled with poor people. That doesn't work. And we can't really have a robust life in a country with a few rich people, lots of poor people. They tried that in South Africa in the 1970s and 80s. It did not end well for the rich people. So that's basically what I'm doing. We're advocating for three policy areas to try to affect that kind of change. One is the lessening of the influence of big money in politics. We want to have a more progressive tax system where rich people have higher tax rates than people that have to work for a living, not lower tax rates, as seems to be the case now after our law from the end of 2017. And we're also advocating for higher wages, particularly the higher minimum wage. One of the things I like to say is that when you go to a bar, the guy who owns the bar should be far more concerned about how much beer money all the people sitting in the bar have on Friday night than about the wages of the one guy who's standing there pouring the beer. And it's true. The same people who were complaining about raising the minimum wage in Seattle, after it happened, they were out there trying to lease more space because so many more people were eating out that they actually need to expand their restaurants and bars. You know, they show us statistics. Oh, look, there are fewer low-wage jobs now after you change these laws, claiming that all these low-wage people are now unemployed. Really, there are more total people employed. There are fewer low-wage people because there are more high-wage people, because the low-wage people got raises and now they have higher wages. That's why there's fewer low-wage people. But there's more people with wages in total. So overall, we're trying to make the case that we want to have a country where people are paid enough to live on and people are able to have a good life. And that's where business people and investors can build businesses and make money.
It sounds like what you're really talking about is that there are real misconceptions out there about how wealth works and how businesses actually thrive. And I just wondered if you feel that you are in the majority of wealthy people, or are you kind of a zebra in the minority of wealthy people?
I think most wealthy people have an understanding of these same things that I'm trying to say, because most people have some kind of businesses where they have to sell stuff to other people. Now, a few don't. If you look, there are some businesses that basically extract minerals from the earth and sell them. Those people who own those businesses, people like in the coal mining business or the oil business, like some of the famous Republican donors, they may have a legitimate case that it doesn't matter to them how much income the people in their communities have. But the vast majority of businesses in the United States can only exist because they have revenue from customers buying stuff. And that's the way most businesses work. I've spent a lot of time in congressional offices talking to a bunch of, 20-something-year-old staffers who think they know something about the Chicago School of Economics because they've read Ayn Rand. And then what they think is that a business person first decides how much profit he wants to make, then looks at his sales, and then whatever the difference is, that's how much he can spend on salaries and buying stuff and expenses. And we can go with actual business people, people that own grocery stores and people that own businesses like that, and explain, well, actually, it's not. The business person looks at how much revenue he makes, looks at how much he needs to pay to get the workers, to hire workers that he needs to hire or buy whatever it is he needs to buy to run his business, and then subtracts. And whatever's left, that's how much profit he wants. That's how much profit he actually makes. He doesn't first determine the profit and then determine how much he can pay the workers. All these young staffers, they think that, if you decrease his taxes, that increases how much he can pay for workers because profit is fixed. Or if he has to increase some expense, well, he has to pay the workers less because profit is fixed. Whereas no, if some expense changes, if his expenses go down, his profit goes up. You don't say, my bodega is charging me less for coffee now than it used to, therefore I'll pay more for my dry cleaning. No one would think of doing that. And the same way, if some business person's taxes go down, he doesn't think, my taxes go down, I don't want to make more money, so I'll spend more money on this thing over here. It doesn't work that way either. So that's the kind of conversations that we can bring in guys who actually own grocery stores or restaurants or something to explain to people in congressional offices.
How did we get here with this extreme level of inequality, if we have the common idea that everyone should have something?
I think a few people who don't think that way, such as David Koch, who he didn't start, but inherited from his father a large business based on oil production, really. They were an oil services company. Or other people who have been extremely active in politics and have got this extremely short-term greed about them. Some of it started in the late 1970s, when corporate raiders started taking over a few companies like TWA, and Michael Douglas had a shirt where the stripes were running horizontally and said, "Greed is good," in the original Wall Street movie. And what they could do, yeah, it's true. They could actually make more money by buying the airline, shutting it down, selling the airplanes and everything else, and they made a profit, and they did. But that wasn't really good for the long term. If you wanted to make even more money, you could have bought the airline and continued to run it and make money for years and years and years. And would have eventually, I don't know about TWA in particular, but in general, it's a difference between a short-term mentality and a long-term mentality. And the United States, with the help of some lawyers and investment bankers and people like that, invented these things where, you could make more money in the short term by taking over a company and shutting it down. Then it moved into private equities and other things like that.
Don't the markets kind of incentivize short-term thinking in the first place, with corporate reports and shareholders demanding every quarter a new bump in profits?
Sometimes, yes, they do. Sometimes not. You look like a company like Amazon, they were not reporting any profits for years, and yet growing to become one of the most valuable companies in the world. So sometimes shareholders are actually thinking more long term. And that worked because no one could take over Amazon, because Mr. Bezos owns over 15% of it, and his friends and family own quite a bit more. And it was even higher until recently. So he wasn't worried about someone taking over his company and realizing that they could, I don't know, buy the stock and sell the data centers and make a small profit. So yeah, I think sometimes it does work that way because of our short-term mentality. And, you know, people buying stocks, not even thinking about the long term, not thinking they're buying a business they want to own for the long term, the way if you were, you know, going to buy the bar down the street, but thinking about it, oh, how will this do next week, next month, this quarter, you know, thinking in time frames of a few months like a trader, not like a business owner.
Morris, I would like to come back to the to this mindset question of the rich. Sort of when there is a, seems to be a sort of an maybe misunderstanding or an, like or maybe a, how do you say where common people don't understand how someone like a rich person doesn't understand, for example, what a salary is. Yeah, it kind of reminds me to an example of Marie Antoinette when she said like let them eat cake. You know, in the French Revolution, let them eat cake, not understanding that bread is needed. And it's basically fat the revolution. Are we on this point of going into a bigger revolution here in the United States?
Well, that's what I'm afraid of. You know, we know we have our friend Nick Hanauer who talked about pitchforks. You know, I went on a protest march just a couple weeks ago with, you know, State Senator Jessica Ramos. People were actually marching with pitchforks from Madison Square to the governor's office on 40th Street. And yeah, I am concerned about that. You know, half the, I don't know about half, but a large proportion of the Trump supporters and a large proportion of the Bernie Sanders supporters answer yes when they're asked, do we need a revolution in this country? That's what I'm afraid of, is that people are not going to take it anymore. You know, we used to have some kind of a social compact that if you worked hard and stuck with your job for years and years, well, you could have a good life and live the American dream as a middle-class family. But we don't have that anymore because on both sides, there's this distrust and there's no long-term thinking. You know, companies don't have pensions anymore. They just, you know, might give you some 401k matches, but it's up to you to figure out what to do with that. And yeah, you're exactly right. That is what I'm concerned about.
So if we achieved the minimum wage, a living wage, and if we achieved a progressive tax system and we got money out of politics, corporate money out of politics, what kind of program or government would you be looking to support? What would be the policies that would make the difference?
I mean, I think if we had a more progressive tax system and higher wages in general, we'd have more income in aggregate, and we'd be able to support things like healthcare and education. I mean, those are the biggest things that, you know, other not the state and local government spend money on. You know, if I was in charge, we'd spend, you know, less money on military forces and more money on education and health care for people.
Although the military does do a lot of cover a lot of employment in the United States, but I guess we'd get the same out of health care and education. I mean, traditionally, you have better paying jobs out of military industrial complex.
Yes. I mean, it's a very difficult case to make. One of our members was talking about sort of a Medicare for all kind of a system and saying that, look, you know, you have all this expense on healthcare, but 20% of it, or a little more, is actually overhead from the running the insurance companies and all the people who argue about payments with each other and people who deny claims and people who appeal denials and this whole sort of middle ground. And then only less than 80% actually goes to the actually paying for healthcare. And oh, if we got rid of that, we'd all say, well, if you got rid of that, then all those people would be unemployed because all those people who deny claims, well, they are also supporting their families too. So yeah, I see your point. But I do think that we could redirect our national income, particularly if we increase the total amount of national income, it could be redirected towards other things. And if people had more money, they would spend it. And if they have more money to spend, then people who used to be making, I don't know, weapons for the military would find something else to do to that they could sell stuff to the people.
Yeah, so a general expansion of what's possible in this economy.
Yeah, and things have changed before. I mean, we used to have a lot more people in agriculture, and then people invented things like the cotton gin and the combine and all kinds of things that greatly reduced the number of people needed to run farms. And those people shifted to different things. There's a huge migration in our country from the south to the north as fewer people were needed to grow cotton and more people were needed to manufacture automobiles. And yeah, things are going to change. And I mean, regardless of what happens with our election, things are going to be very different 20, 30 years from now than they are now. And well, hopefully my grandchildren will have the kind of opportunities that I do.
It sounds like a lot of what you're talking about in terms of increasing wages and progressive taxation is more or less adjustments to the system that basically works. And we've had a lot of debates on this show about whether or not capitalism is the best economic model or some other form of hybrid socialist model. Stephanie's from Switzerland, and of course they have social democracy. What are your thoughts about the general model of the economy?
There's not been any country running a purely capitalist model, certainly not in the last few centuries anyway. We have a huge role for government in our economy now. You know, we depend on all kinds of things from our government. You know, everything from law enforcement to, you know, all the rules and regulations that we run under. You know, in theory, you could say, oh, the invisible hand of Adam Smith will, you know, people will be convinced to only buy stuff from companies that don't cause air pollution. Well, no, that doesn't work. You can't sit here in New York and know, you know, which brand of milk is made by people who run sound long-term farms, you know, hundreds of miles from here, and which ones don't. You know, you can't possibly evaluate, you know, medicine and decide which ones are effective on your own accord. And you don't want to either. You know, you don't want to be in a position where anybody can sell you medicine and, well, after a few years, the ones who sell medicine that doesn't work will have a lower reputation and people will be dead. You know, that's not the kind of system that we want. You know, we don't want a system where anybody can manufacture airplanes and eventually people will get the hang of which ones have a better reputation of not killing people. No, we want all airplanes. You know, we want to know that we can only fly around in airplanes that people have tested and evaluated and are likely not to kill people. You know, you have no way of evaluating a bank to decide if it makes safe investments or not. That's why we have an FDIC. You can deposit money in your bank and you can be reasonably assured, well, you can be absolutely assured that no matter what the bank does, you'll get your money back because either the bank will repay you or the government will. So we have all kinds of systems. You know, in order to make capitalism work, it needs a lot of things from the government. And yeah, I mean, different countries have slight variations on that, but the things I've been talking about are true in virtually all advanced Western countries in the world.
So Morris, before Patriarch Millionaires, you had a very successful career in the financial industry. When you saw deregulations on corporate contributions and things like Citizens United being passed, did you have a sense that those changes would create the imbalances you're fighting against now?
No, not really. It's not all that obvious. At least it wasn't to me, and it still isn't to most people, apparently. But I do think that a lot of our problem is indirectly caused by the issues of money and politics. Oh, and just one aside, of course, I didn't say, but it's obvious that I'm very fortunate to be in the position where I don't have to continue working for a living to earn a living. I've had the good fortune of earning enough money over the years that I'm able to do advocacy work full time. But getting back to that, I think that our congresspeople, our representatives, our senators, I think that a lot of them, not all, but a lot of them are good people, but they spend all of their time, not all, but a huge amount of their time, doing fundraising. And it's not that they say, oh, my donor wants this law to be changed, so I better change it. No, it is occasionally that. But mostly it's that, oh, there's this law here and I don't really know much about, but this guy that I met the other night knows all about it. And he said, this is a really bad idea. So we should change it. And the fact is that the Congress people spend a lot of time with the donors by necessity because they need donations. And so that's the point of view they hear all the time. And many things are not obvious. Things like bank deregulation. You don't often meet with people who are telling you why banks should be regulated in order to, prevent future bailouts. You do occasionally, but not generally. But you can meet with a lot of people who work in banks and can tell you how their profits would be higher and their income would be better without these pesky little regulations that, some unelected bureaucrats came up with. So I think it's inevitable under the system that our elected representatives have to spend huge amounts of time with fundraising that they get that point of view a lot. And so that's why I think that changing our campaign finance system, as is proposed in H.R. 1 that passed the House of Representatives some time ago, would really help a lot.
I mean, we have seen in history already, that there is extreme inequality, poverty and equality, with then a defunctioning of government, while government is such an important role, right? And then we are exactly in the same position again, where we've I may say government is crumbling, or corrupt, or whatever is the word. How do you get within patriarchal millionaires, whatever the rich could do to fix that problem? I think the common denominator here is the role of government and how to control all this.
Well, what we are doing with our, dozen or so staffers and a few hundred members, what we are doing is advocating for a few policies, one of which is campaign finance reform, which I think would go a great distance towards solving some of the problem. And overall, I think our philosophy is that government actually can solve certain problems and government can be a force for good. And that's what I've been talking about. There are certain functions which cannot be done without government. And some of them are obvious. The Food and Drug Administration. As we've been saying, you cannot possibly have each person decide for themselves whether the medicine is safe. Well, I mean, that used to happen, and lots of people got unsafe medicine and died. And eventually, some people had reputations for making safe medicine, but it required a lot of people to die first. And airplanes and cars and all kinds of safety regulations. There's lots of things that we can do collectively that we cannot do individually and don't want to do individually even. So I think that part of my job is to make the case that we need government. It's not the case, Ronald Reagan said the scariest words in the English language, I'm from the government, I'm here to help you. I'd like to change that. I'd like to say, no, that's not right. We want to run a system where there are certain things we want the government to do. Government is just a word we use for people acting collectively, acting together. And there are certain things we can do together that we can't do individually.
I think as a wrapping up kind of statement, is there any question that you think we didn't ask that would touch on some of something that you're very passionate about? Or is there some message you would like listeners to hear?
Well, the basic idea is that I want to provide for my children and now grandchild the kind of America where I grew up in, for them to grow up in. So that's what I'm trying to do, is to help provide for them the same kind of America where I grew up in. We just have to go back to the point where we depend on our government, where people who are rich paid higher tax rates, and the government had that money and used it to provide things for the rest of the people. And we can do that again.
It's really awesome work, and we really appreciate it. It's, for me, it's a surprise and an inspiration that people are being vocal about this, people who have something to lose and are boldly moving forward with the kind of action that you're taking. And anything we can do to join that spirit, we would be more than happy to.
See, I'm not even sure which way I have something more to lose, you know? It's hard to say which way is the riskier way. I think there's a big risk in not arresting this growing inequality.
Hear, hear.
Great. Thank you, Mel, Stephanie, Riley.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I think it's pretty special that a group of what we might call privileged people are talking about raising their taxes. Because in my experience, in almost every context, it's very difficult to get people to think about giving up that privilege in any form. And here we have an entire organization of millionaires saying, raise our taxes, please. That's pretty special.
Yeah, so we have a couple of people who are rich in money, who got rich in money through the system as we had designed it over the last couple of decades. Right, who basically
got
through, got
rich, or what, or grandparents, right?
No, I mean, I don't want to criticize that club. I think it's very, very cool what they do, which is basically advocating for policy changes and very, very necessary policy changes if we want to sustain our democracy. I mean, we have a whole episode about this, right? How important it is to get money out of politics. So they talk about campaign finance, policies such as taxes, raising taxes, kind of obvious stuff to do.
Mm-hmm. But right? Stuff that's obviously hard to do as well. I mean, we've had 40 years of tax breaks for the rich in America, and they're saying that's too much. We need to redistribute income.
Yeah, but why are they saying it's too much? Because it doesn't work for anyone anymore, including themselves.
That's why they're saying it.
And as we've pointed out within the episode, we had these kind of situations before in human history, you know.
Yes.
And so we are coming to a point where we are breaking down as a society. It just doesn't work anymore, and even doesn't work for the rich any longer. So, let's do something about it. Of course, as you say, it is more powerful to, if a millionaire says, hey, I should pay more taxes, it's way more powerful than the poor guy saying, hey, you should pay more taxes.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think it's praiseworthy, is, like, you know, taking responsibility for the situation and doing something about it. I think privilege, going back to this whole notion of privilege, is a bit of a trap for everyone. You know, I don't think most people were wealthy said, let me get so wealthy that the rest of the world can't relate to me or can't survive. I think people are in a trap, whatever part of the economic spectrum they're in, and that trap is our system that teaches you, like, you just should keep getting richer, even if you're rich. And they're saying, no, we don't need to keep getting richer and richer. I mean, we'll get
richer. That reminds me, see, we had that before in human history. And even poets like Johann Wolfgang Goethe.
Goethe. I think we call it Goethe.
Oh, man. You know, but I looked it up. It's the Zauberlehrling, and in English, it's the sorcerer's, What is it? Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yes, we know about that one from Mickey Mouse. You know, Disney did a whole production.
That's so nice. That's fantastic.
It's, actually, you should watch it. It's really funny.
Right. But the point is, in the poem where, I don't know what Mickey Mouse does, but in The Sorcerer's Apprentice of Goethe, the spirits are called and they work wonderfully to help the apprentice basically do all the work. And the water is getting, is brought into the house, and then he has enough water and he wants to stop it, so that he kind of switched on the machine, and then he can't stop this machine anymore.
Yes.
And he doesn't have the spell to stop it. And he literally says in the poem,
when you're saying this, all I see is Mickey Mouse floating with that big bucket, and like he's drenched in all the water, and the mops are all over the place trying to mop it up, and it's very funny. Yes. He cannot stop the spells. And I think what you're saying is the wealthy can't stop this machine either.
The spirits I summoned, I can't get rid of them. Right? You don't have the spell to stop it. And that's exactly the situation in a way we were in. Like we switched on the machine, not this generation, I mean a couple of generations before. It has worked wonderfully for us. And since the 80s with Reagan and all these policy changes, you know, the rich became even richer, and it has become this wonderful wave of, yes, we are wealthy, we are rich, but how now it just doesn't work anymore. You know, we almost become too rich, right?
Right.
There is too much inequality. It just doesn't work anymore. What's the spell to stop it?
Right.
And it seems to me we're not really finding the spell.
Well, I mean, look, we have one spell, which is called the pandemic. It stopped it for a little bit. And that's
not
both
really,
a lesson.
Mel. You know, I would even say it's an accelerator of, or a magnifying glass of how deep the inequality in this country
that's
is.
True. Yeah, yeah, no question.
Right. So how to stop that spell, I think, for us, quite frankly, is to kind of see beyond the veil. And that is, I do believe we have, if we learn from history, if we'd really seen how this as a system doesn't work any longer for our society. And we've learned from Extinction Rebellion, you know, that we are not just talking about a little issue here, a little hiccup in human history. It actually means that we could go extinct, and the planet would be happy about that. You know, it's...
We're talking about human survival, not planetary survival.
So if human wants to survive, we have a little window of time at the moment. And this is where my hope is, or my learning in this episode is, like, can we take this opportunity of that little time frame and go beyond just taxes, policies, and campaign finance?
Wholly agree. But I think that's the beginning. Like, those are important and necessary steps, not necessarily sufficient steps. We need to do more systemic changes in order to kind of take advantage of this window of opportunity. But, you know, I think that these are systemic changes to change the tax structure and get money out of politics. Very important things that will restore some balance. And then we've got to go to work on the deeper things that you're talking about, which are what? Like the monetary policy?
I'm talking about a mind shift. But we are still talking, especially here in America, about one winner takes it all. And it's not just in money, or it's not just how the money system works here at the moment. It's also in politics. It's just one winner take it all. And that cannot work for us anymore. So we have to shift it, and I hope we're going to take this window seriously. And it's now.
Yep. I hope so too.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore.
Thanks for listening.